A sloth, a donkey, and a curious human. Send a prompt and see what they're doing. One hits a record with a question on his mind. Two brothers pick it up, see what they find. Corn takes his time, Herman's got the facts. Back and forth, they never hold back. My weird prompts, come on in, that's where we begin. My weird prompts, glad you're here.
This episode was generated using artificial intelligence. Please verify facts.
Daniel sent us this one. He's asking about public procurement and tendering, specifically for someone who's never done it before. He mentions the window dressing problem, where a government body puts out a tender because they're legally obligated to, but they've already decided who's getting the contract. They just need a few more quotes so it looks competitive. He also wants to know how a small business can find opportunities and respond to tenders without wasting time on those sham processes. Which is a very good question to ask before you burn 6 weeks on a bid that was never going anywhere.
Right, and this is one of those areas where the gap between the official story and what actually happens is massive. I've spent a fair amount of time looking at procurement frameworks, partly from my medical background, partly just because I find regulatory systems fascinating. Most of what people know about government tendering is either outdated or comes from horror stories about the worst-case scenario.
Let's start with the thing everyone worries about. The fix is in. The winner is pre-chosen. And you're just there to make up the numbers. How real is that?
It's real enough that it has a name in procurement circles. Tailoring. Not even a euphemism, just a straight description. You write the tender specification so precisely around one company's capabilities that only they can meet every requirement. Maybe you require a certification that only one firm holds, or experience on a project that, conveniently, only one firm has done. The OECD has been tracking this for years, and their procurement reviews consistently flag tailored specifications as one of the top integrity risks.
Sounds almost charming, like a bespoke suit.
It's the bespoke suit of corruption. But here's the thing, it's not the majority of tenders. The OECD's data suggests outright rigged processes are maybe 10 to 15% of tenders in higher risk sectors. The bigger problem is that small businesses assume it's 100%, so they never even look.
Which is its own kind of self-fulfilling prophecy. If only the insiders bother to bid, the insiders keep winning.
Governments know this is a problem. Israel's procurement system, which is what the prompt is specifically asking about, is actually pretty transparent by global standards. The Mandatory Tenders Law, dating back to 1992, requires public bodies to publish tenders above certain thresholds. Since around 2016, most of that has moved online through the government procurement portal. Every tender above the threshold goes up there. It's public. Anyone can look.
Step one is literally just knowing the website exists.
And most small businesses don't. They assume government work requires some secret handshake or a cousin in the ministry. But the actual process starts with a publicly posted document anyone can download. In Israel, the main portal is the Israel Government Procurement Administration site. It lists open tenders, closed ones, awarded contracts, everything. The World Bank has been pushing this kind of transparency globally for decades. Their procurement framework explicitly requires open publication of tender notices, and most countries now comply, at least formally.
Even if it's published, the document itself is probably a nightmare to read.
Oh, it's terrible. Tender documents are written in a dialect of legalese that seems designed to make you give up on paragraph 2, but that's actually an opportunity.
How is deliberately unreadable prose an opportunity?
Because most of your competitors give up on paragraph 2. If you can learn to read a tender document efficiently, scanning for the 5 or 6 things that actually matter, you're already ahead of most small firms who just see a wall of text and close the tab.
Okay, so let's talk about those 5 or 6 things. What are you looking for when you open one of these documents?
First, the threshold requirements. These are usually right near the top. Minimum annual revenue, required certifications, years of experience, insurance requirements. If you don't meet these, stop reading. You're done. This is where a lot of small businesses get burned. They spend hours reading the full document, get excited about the scope of work, and then discover on page 47 that they need 5 years of audited financials and they've only been in business for 3.
It's a disqualification checklist first, not a to-do list.
The threshold requirements are binary. You either meet them or you don't. Government procurement is not like private sector sales where you can talk your way past a missing credential. The evaluation committee is legally bound by the published criteria. If the tender says minimum annual turnover of 2 million shekels and you have 1.8, your bid gets disqualified automatically. The committee doesn't even read the rest.
What's number two?
The evaluation criteria and their weights. Every tender has to publish how bids will be scored. It's usually some combination of price and quality. In professional services, architecture, engineering, legal work, it's often weighted toward quality. You might see 70% technical proposal, 30% price. The key is to find out early whether this is a price-driven tender or a quality-driven tender. If it's 90% price and you're a premium boutique firm, you're probably wasting your time.
A lot of small firms probably bid on price-driven tenders, thinking they can differentiate on quality, not realizing the scoring system makes that mathematically impossible.
It's heartbreaking how often that happens. I've seen beautifully written proposals that never stood a chance because the scoring formula meant a 2% price difference outweighed everything else. The OECD's procurement guidelines explicitly recommend that contracting authorities publish the evaluation methodology in advance, and most do, but bidders often don't read that section carefully enough.
Thresholds, evaluation criteria. What's the third thing?
The scope of work and deliverables. This sounds obvious, but you need to read it with a skeptical eye. Is it clearly defined, or is it vague? Vague scope in a government tender is a red flag. It often means the contracting authority doesn't really know what it wants, which means the project will be a mess to deliver. Or, and this is where the window dressing concern comes in. The scope was written loosely on purpose because the preferred vendor already knows what's expected from prior conversations.
A vague scope could be incompetence, or it could be a tell.
It's usually incompetence, honestly. The fourth thing to look for is the submission requirements and deadlines. Government tenders are fanatical about deadlines. If the submission deadline is Tuesday at noon and your courier arrives at 12:03, your bid is rejected. No exceptions, no appeals. The deadline is sacred in a way that nothing else in government is.
Which is actually one of the few genuinely fair parts of the process. Everyone gets the same clock.
It is fair, but it also means you need to work backwards from the deadline and be realistic about whether you can produce a quality response in the time available. A professional services tender response, a good one, takes 40 to 80 hours of work. If the deadline is 5 days from now and you're a solo practitioner, you probably can't do it properly.
The fifth thing?
The clarification process. Every tender has a window where you can submit questions to the contracting authority, and their answers become part of the official tender record, binding on everyone. This is your best tool for sniffing out whether the process is genuine.
How does asking a question tell you if the fix is in?
Because the quality of the answers tells you a lot. If you ask a substantive question, we notice the scope requires experience with System X, but the technical specifications reference System Y, can you clarify? And you get a thoughtful, detailed answer, that's a good sign. If you get a one-line brush-off, or if your question is ignored entirely, that's a data point. If the answers are consistently evasive, or seem designed to preserve ambiguity rather than resolve it, that's another data point. The clarification process is a window into how the contracting authority actually behaves, not just what the tender document says.
It's almost like a cheap due diligence mechanism. Before you invest 80 hours in a proposal, you invest 2 hours in crafting smart questions and see what comes back.
Here's something most small firms don't realize. Participating in the clarification process puts your name on the radar in a legitimate way. The contracting authority sees that you're engaging seriously. It doesn't give you an advantage in scoring, but it signals that you're a real bidder, not someone who just downloaded the document and disappeared.
Let's talk about the window dressing scenario more directly. How do you spot a tender that's already decided?
There are patterns. The most obvious is an unrealistically short response window. If a complex professional services tender gives bidders 2 weeks to respond, that's suspicious. A proper architectural services tender should have a minimum of 4 to 6 weeks. When the window is compressed, it often means the preferred vendor has been working on their response for months already, and the short window is designed to prevent anyone else from mounting a serious bid.
The deadline itself is the tell.
The deadline, the specificity of the requirements, and the evaluation criteria. If you see a tender that requires experience designing municipal buildings in a specific city of 50,000 people and also requires certification in a niche sustainability standard and also requires a local office within a 5-kilometer radius of the city center, that's not a coincidence. That's a tender written around someone's CV.
The municipal equivalent of must have 3 arms and be named Steve.
Another pattern is when the tender documents reference internal knowledge that isn't publicly available. If the scope says something like, as discussed in the pre-tender consultation meeting of March 15th, and you were never invited to any pre-tender consultation meeting, that's a red flag. Pre-tender consultations are sometimes legitimate. The World Bank procurement framework even encourages them for complex projects, but they have to be openly announced and accessible to all potential bidders.
What about the flip side? What does a competitive tender look like?
It looks boring. It looks procedural. The requirements are generic enough that multiple firms could meet them, but specific enough that you understand what's being asked. The evaluation criteria are clear and weighted sensibly. The timeline is realistic. The clarification answers are thorough. And often, the tender documents reference industry standards or recognized frameworks rather than proprietary solutions. If a tender references ISO standards or local building codes rather than specific products or vendors, that's usually a good sign.
Boredom is a virtue signal in procurement.
The most ethical tender you'll ever read is also the most tedious. That's almost a law of nature.
All right, so let's say you've done your due diligence, you've decided a tender looks genuine, and you want to bid. What does the actual response process look like for a small business?
The first thing to understand is that a tender response is not a sales pitch. This is the single biggest mistake small businesses make. They write a proposal the way they'd write a pitch to a private client, all about their passion, their philosophy, their unique approach. Government evaluators do not care about your passion. They care about whether you meet the published criteria and can demonstrate it with evidence.
It's more like filling out a very long form than writing a love letter.
It is exactly like filling out a very long form. Many tenders now use structured response templates where you literally fill in boxes. Each box corresponds to an evaluation criterion. Your job is to put the right evidence in the right box, in the order the evaluator expects to see it. If the criterion says demonstrate experience with projects of similar scope and complexity, you don't write a narrative about your firm's history. You list 3 to 5 relevant projects, with budgets, timelines, client references, and a brief description of what you delivered. Bullet points are your friend.
Which means the creative part of the proposal is mostly structural, organizing the evidence, not waxing poetic.
This is where small firms actually have an advantage they don't realize. A small architecture firm might have done 10 projects, but they know every detail of every project. A large firm might have done 200 projects, but the person writing the proposal is a junior associate who's never been on a job site. The small firm can produce a more specific, more credible response because the person writing it actually did the work.
The key is detailed specificity, not volume.
Give the evaluator exactly what the criterion asks for, with concrete evidence. If they ask for a project manager's CV, don't send the firm's managing partner's CV with a note saying they'll oversee everything. Send the CV of the person who will actually manage the project, with relevant experience highlighted. Evaluators can smell padding from a mile away.
What about pricing? That seems like the hardest part for a small firm. How do you price a government tender without either leaving money on the table or pricing yourself out?
Pricing strategy for government tenders is its own discipline, but the short version is, you need to understand the evaluation formula before you set your price. If the tender is 70% quality and 30% price, and the price scoring works on a relative basis, meaning the lowest bid gets full marks and everyone else gets proportionally less, then being 10% above the lowest bid might cost you very little in overall scoring. You can price at market rate and still win if your quality score is strong. But if it's 50-50, or if the price scoring is aggressive, you need to be much more competitive.
How do you know what the market rate even is for government work? It's not like there's a published price list.
This is where the transparency of the system helps you. Awarded contracts are published. In Israel, you can look up what the government paid for similar architectural services in the past. The contract award notices include the winning bid amount. If you spend a few hours researching comparable tenders before you price your own bid, you'll have a much better sense of the range. Most small firms skip this step because it feels like homework. But it's the difference between pricing blind and pricing with data.
The process is find the tender, check the thresholds, read the evaluation criteria, ask smart questions, research comparable awards, then write a structured, evidence-heavy response with realistic pricing. Not easy, but manageable.
It's absolutely manageable. The barrier isn't complexity. It's that nobody teaches small businesses how to do this. There's no government tendering 101 in architecture school or business school. You either learn by doing, or you hire a consultant, or you just never try.
Let's talk about the never try part. The prompt mentioned that many small organizations feel they're too small to win government work. Is that a misconception?
It's a partial misconception. There are tenders that require scale. A nationwide infrastructure project, a multi-year IT systems integration. But governments also buy an enormous volume of professional services at the small to medium scale. A municipality needs an architect for a community center renovation. A government hospital needs a design review for a new wing. A ministry needs a graphic designer for an awareness campaign. These are not massive contracts. They're 50,000 shekels, 100,000 shekels, 200,000 shekels. Perfectly sized for a small firm.
Those smaller tenders probably attract fewer bidders because the big firms don't bother with them.
The big firms are chasing the multi-million shekel contracts. The small and medium tenders often have surprisingly little competition. I've seen tenders for professional services in the 100,000 shekel range that got two or three bids. In some cases, only one responsive bid. If you're the only qualified bidder who actually submitted a complete response, you win by default as long as your price is reasonable.
Which circles back to the earlier point about most people assuming the process is rigged and not even looking.
The perception of rigging is a bigger barrier than actual rigging. That's not to minimize the real problem. Tailored specifications and predetermined outcomes do happen, and they're corrosive. But the overcorrection, where small firms assume every tender is wired, keeps them out of processes they could win.
What about consortium bidding? If you're a small architecture firm and a tender requires capabilities you don't have in-house, structural engineering, say, or landscape design, can you team up with other small firms?
Yes, and this is explicitly allowed in most procurement frameworks. The Israel Mandatory Tenders Law permits joint bidding. You form a consortium, designate a lead firm, and submit a single bid. The key is that the consortium as a whole must meet the threshold requirements. So if the tender requires an annual turnover of 3 million shekels, and your firm does 1.5 million, and your partner firm does 2 million, you clear the bar together.
Even though neither of you would qualify individually.
And this is one of the most underutilized strategies in government procurement. Small firms are often reluctant to partner with other small firms because they worry about dividing the pie or losing control. But a consortium bid turns two firms that couldn't bid into one bidder that can. It's pure upside. The OECD's procurement principles explicitly encourage authorities to design tenders in ways that don't disadvantage small and medium enterprises, and consortium bidding is one of the mechanisms they recommend.
Let's go back to the window dressing problem for a moment. What do you actually do if you suspect a tender is rigged? Is there any recourse?
There is, but it depends on the jurisdiction and the stage of the process. In Israel, bidders can file an objection with the tender committee before the submission deadline if they believe the tender conditions are discriminatory or tailored. If the tender has already been awarded, you can petition the administrative court. The World Bank and OECD frameworks both emphasize the importance of an independent review mechanism. But practically speaking, challenging a tender is time-consuming, expensive, and often burns bridges with the contracting authority. Most small firms conclude, probably correctly, that it's not worth the fight.
The smarter play is to identify the suspect tenders early and simply not bid on them.
Your time is your most limited resource as a small business. Spending 80 hours on a bid that was never going to be evaluated fairly is worse than spending 0 hours and missing a real opportunity. The skill is learning to distinguish the real from the sham before you invest.
We've given some tools for that. The compressed timeline, the hyper-specific requirements, the evasive clarification answers. Are there any other tells?
One that's often overlooked, look at who won the previous tender for the same or similar services. If the same firm has won the last three consecutive contracts with this contracting authority, and the tender documents for the new one look substantially similar to the old ones, that's not proof of anything, but it's a pattern worth noting. It could just mean they're the only qualified firm, or it could mean the process is designed to keep them in place.
What about the opposite scenario? A contracting authority that wants new bidders, but doesn't know how to attract them.
This is more common than people think. Government procurement officials are often frustrated by the lack of competition. They publish a tender and get one or two bids, or sometimes none at all. They want more bidders. It makes their process look better, gives them more options, and reduces their risk of a failed tender. Some authorities now hold pre-tender information sessions or industry days specifically to encourage small firms to participate.
Those sessions are publicly announced?
They should be. If you're serious about government work, you should be monitoring the procurement portals regularly, not just when you're looking for a contract. Subscribe to the notifications. Follow the contracting authorities that buy the kind of services you offer. Attend the industry days. Build a presence so that when a relevant tender drops, you're not introducing yourself from scratch.
It's partly a marketing function, even though the actual tender evaluation is supposed to be anonymous and criteria-based.
The evaluation is criteria-based, but awareness is not. The tender document doesn't care if it knows you, but you need to know the tender exists. And the procurement officials who run industry days and answer clarification questions, they're human beings. If they've seen your firm engaging thoughtfully before a tender even comes out, that doesn't influence the scoring. But it might mean they design future tenders in ways that don't inadvertently exclude firms like yours.
That's a subtle distinction, but an important one. The process is supposed to be blind, but the pre-process is not.
And this is where small firms often misunderstand the rules of the game. They think blind process means don't talk to anyone. It doesn't. You can and should engage with contracting authorities before a tender is published. Ask what's coming up. Request to be added to notification lists. All of that is perfectly legitimate. What you can't do is try to influence the evaluation after bids are submitted.
Let's shift to the practical mechanics for a moment. The prompt asked about responding to tenders in a time-effective manner. If you're a small architecture firm and you found a tender that looks genuine, what does your workflow look like?
I'd break it into four phases. Phase one is the go or no-go decision, which should take no more than 2 hours. Download the tender documents, scan the threshold requirements, read the evaluation criteria, check the deadline. If you clear the thresholds and the timeline is workable, move to phase two.
Phase two being
detailed reading and clarification. Spend maybe 4 to 6 hours really understanding the scope, the deliverables, and the submission requirements. Draft your clarification questions. While you're waiting for answers, start gathering the administrative documents. Business license, insurance certificates, tax clearance, all the boilerplate that every tender requires. This is tedious, but it's the same for every bid, so keep a folder with all your standard compliance documents updated and ready to go.
You're not scrambling for your insurance certificate at 11 p.m. the night before the deadline.
You would be amazed how many firms do exactly that. Phase three is the substantive response. This is where you write the technical proposal, the project approach, the team CVs, the relevant experience. This is the 40 to 60 hour chunk. And the key here is to write to the evaluation criteria. Literally structure your response in the same order as the criteria with the same headings. Make it impossible for the evaluator to miss how you meet each requirement.
Because the evaluator is probably reading 20 of these, and they're looking for reasons to eliminate bids, not reasons to keep them.
The evaluator's job is to score against the published criteria. If they can't find the evidence for criterion 3.2, you lose those points, even if the evidence is buried somewhere in your proposal under a different heading. Don't make them hunt. Serve it to them on a platter. Review, pricing, and submission. Have someone who wasn't involved in writing read the entire response against the tender requirements. Check every checkbox. Verify every attachment. Price, the bid based on your research of comparable awards and your own cost structure. Then submit at least 24 hours before the deadline because procurement portals have a tendency to crash on deadline day.
That's a very specific piece of hard-won wisdom.
Every experienced bidder has a story about a portal crash. Every single one.
What about the pricing itself? You mentioned researching comparable awards. How granular can you get with that?
In Israel, the contract award notices are public. You can see the winning bid amount, the number of bidders, and sometimes the range of bids received. If you do this consistently, over time you build a database of what the market actually pays for architectural services in the public sector. It's not perfect. Every project is different, but it gives you a benchmark. Without that benchmark, you're pricing in the dark.
I imagine there's a temptation for small firms to underprice, thinking they need to be the cheapest to win.
That's a dangerous strategy for two reasons. One, if you win at an unsustainably low price, you now have to deliver the project at that price, and government contracts are not easy to renegotiate. Two, evaluators are often suspicious of bids that are dramatically lower than the competition. Many procurement frameworks have a mechanism for investigating abnormally low bids. If you can't justify your price, your bid can be rejected even if it's the cheapest.
Being too cheap can get you disqualified.
The goal is to be competitive, not desperate. Competitive means your price is in the range of what similar services have cost in similar tenders. Desperate means you're 50% below everyone else and the evaluator assumes you misunderstood the scope.
Let's zoom out for a moment. The prompt mentioned that this is about professional services, architecture specifically. Are there peculiarities about tendering for professional services versus, say, buying office furniture?
Professional services tenders are what procurement people call quality-based selection, as opposed to lowest price. The intellectual content matters. For architecture specifically, the tender will often require a conceptual design or a design approach as part of the submission. This is a significant investment. You're essentially doing preliminary design work for free, on spec. That's the cost of bidding for architectural work in the public sector, and it's one of the reasons the window dressing problem stings so much. If you spend 2 weeks developing a conceptual design for a tender that was never going to be evaluated fairly, you've lost not just time, but creative work.
That's a real risk. How do you manage it?
By being selective about which tenders you pursue architecturally. The due diligence we talked about earlier, checking the deadline, the specificity of requirements, the clarification process, becomes even more important when the bid requires creative output. You should also look at whether the tender pays an honorarium to shortlisted firms. Some larger architectural competitions do. If there's no honorarium and the tender has red flags, the expected value of bidding may be negative.
Expected value? Now you sound like an economist.
I've been reading procurement economics papers. It's a surprisingly rich field. There's fascinating work on bidder behavior in public tenders, including studies on how the perception of corruption affects participation rates. A 2022 paper in the Journal of Public Procurement found that firms who believe a tender is rigged are not only less likely to bid on that tender, but less likely to bid on any government tender for the next 12 months. The chilling effect outlasts the specific incident.
One bad experience poisons the whole well.
For that firm, yes. Which is why the due diligence up front is so important. If you can avoid the sham processes and only bid on genuine ones, your experience with government procurement will be positive, or at least neutral. You'll win some, you'll lose some, but you won't feel like you were cheated.
What about the post-award phase? If you do win, what should a small firm expect in terms of contracting and payment?
Government contracts are thorough. They'll specify deliverables, timelines, payment milestones, liability provisions, insurance requirements, dispute resolution mechanisms. Read the contract before you sign it, obviously. But the most important thing for a small firm to know about government payment is that it's slow but reliable. The government always pays eventually. It might take 60 or 90 days. But unlike a private client who might dispute an invoice or go out of business, the government is not going to stiff you. You just need to manage your cash flow accordingly.
It's predictable. Slow, not risky slow.
And some governments are faster than others. Israel's payment practices for government contracts have improved in recent years, partly due to reforms that penalize late payments. But you should still plan for a 60-day cycle and be pleasantly surprised if it's faster.
What about the relationship after the contract is signed? Is there an ongoing engagement, or is it purely transactional?
It depends on the contract type. Some are fixed, scope, fixed price, deliver it, and you're done. Others are framework agreements where you're on a list of pre-qualified suppliers and they call you as needed. Framework agreements are gold for small firms because they provide a steady pipeline of work without requiring a new tender each time. If you can get onto a government framework agreement for architectural services, that's a very good position to be in.
Getting onto a framework agreement is itself a competitive process.
Yes, but once you're on it for the duration, usually 2 to 4 years. The initial effort to win a framework slot pays off over multiple assignments.
All right, I want to circle back to something you said earlier about the perception of rigging being a bigger barrier than actual rigging. If you were talking to a small architecture firm that's never done government work and they're skeptical that it's worth the effort, what's your one-sentence case?
The government is the largest single buyer of professional services in the country. It publishes exactly what it wants to buy and how it will choose, and most of your competitors are too cynical to even read the document.
That's a pretty compelling case.
It's the truth. The barriers to entry in government procurement are real, but they're largely informational, not structural. Once you understand how to read a tender, how to structure a response, and how to spot the red flags, you're in a position to compete. Most small firms never get past the "it's all rigged" assumption.
The ones who do get past it,
they find that government work, while bureaucratic and slow, is also stable, predictable, and often quite profitable. Public sector clients don't haggle after the contract is signed. They don't demand endless revisions outside the scope. They don't go bankrupt halfway through the project. For a small firm, that predictability is worth a lot.
Even with the 60-day payment terms.
Even with the 60-day payment terms. You build that into your pricing and your cash flow planning. It's a known variable, and known variables are manageable.
The summary for someone who's never done this before. Monitor the procurement portals. Learn to read tender documents for the 5 or 6 things that matter. Use the clarification process as both a due diligence tool and a signaling mechanism. Write structured evidence-based responses. Price based on research, not guesswork. Submit early. And don't let cynicism about window dressing keep you from real opportunities.
That's the playbook. It's not glamorous. It's not the stuff of business bestsellers. But it works.
Now, Hilbert's daily fun fact.
In antiquity, seaweed harvesting communities along the Aral Sea Basin numbered approximately 3,000 specialized practitioners who passed down harvesting techniques through at least 17 distinct family lineages, each with their own designated coastal territories.
Specialized practitioners of a sea that doesn't exist anymore.
Right. This has been My Weird Prompts. Thanks to our producer, Hilbert Flumingtop. If you enjoyed this episode, please leave us a review wherever you listen to podcasts. It helps.
I'm Corn. I'm Corn.
I'm Herman Poppleberry.
See you next time.
This episode's script was written by DeepSeek V4 Pro, with text-to-speech by Chatterbox.
Thanks for listening to our show, My Weird Prompts, where odd thoughts go. From sloth's slow takes to facts on cue, we chase the strange and follow through. Some nights it's news, some nights it's lore, a thought you've never heard before. The host dig in, the host dig deep. The stranger the prompt, the less they sleep. From tiny questions, big ones too. From half-formed hunches to deja vu. If something odd is in your head, send it in, we'll chase the thread. My weird prompts, that's the close. From sloth, from man, from long-eared host. My weird prompts, until next time. Stay curious, keep weird in mind.